Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by and welcome to today's webinar. We have with us today Mr. Nicolas Bornozis, President of Capital Link, organizer of the event. I must advise that this webinar is being recorded today. I would now like to hand the call over to Mr. Bornozis. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Good morning to everyone. This is Nicolas Bornozis, President of Capital Link, and we are the organizers of today's webinar. And thank you for joining us. Today's webcast will feature SS&C, Alps Advisors, and Allerian on the topic of 2020 MLP and Energy Infrastructure Outlook. This webinar has been approved for one CFP credit. We're delighted to have with us Paul Biocci, Senior Sales Support Analyst at SS&C Alps Advisors, and Stacey Morris, Director of Research at Allerian. This event is accessible through a live audio webcast and then also as an audio archive through www.capitallinkwebinars.com. There is a Q&A session after the presentation. Webinar participants can submit questions through the sidebar on the presentation page titled Ask a Question, or email them to questions@capitallinkwebinars.com. Please note you can submit a question anytime during the event and it will be answered during the Q&A period. The opinions expressed by the presenters are not intended as legal or investment advice or advice of any kind, as a matter of fact, and are provided for informational and educational purposes only. And Capital Link bears no responsibility for them. Furthermore, this presentation may contain forward-looking statements concerning future events. And in closing, please save the date for Capital Link's 19th Annual Closed-End Funds and Global ETFs Forum, which will take place on Tuesday, April 7, 2020 at the Metropolitan Club in New York. We are particularly proud that this event is now in the 19th consecutive year. That's quite an achievement. We look forward to having you with us. For more information, please visit forums.capitallink.com. Thank you again for joining us, and now I will turn the floor to Paul. Paul, please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Nicolas, and thank you all for joining us. We certainly appreciate you taking the time out of your day to join us and get a perspective on the MLP and energy infrastructure space. It is our intention over the next hour or so to really lay out a foundation of A, what happened in 2019, and B, what we expect from the space moving forward in 2020. Ultimately, when you look at the agenda slide, you get a feel for how we've laid out the presentation, but the goal is to spell out what we think is the strong fundamental backbone of the MLP and infrastructure space, which has improved markedly over the course of the past 5 years, and then also spell out a case for why the space, the category, if you will, is perhaps undervalued relative to other categories in the market or relative to where it's been historically, and then talk about how MLP investments or energy infrastructure investments fit within a portfolio context, how they compare to other income-producing asset classes, and some of the points of differentiation between RIC-compliant and C-Corp investment strategies in this category. And so before I dive into some of those topics, I'm going to hand it over to Stacey Morris, as Nicolas mentioned, Director of Research at Allerian, who's the sort of gold standard provider of MLP and energy infrastructure research, content creation, and index creation, dating back over a decade, having created the first MLP-centric index that was launched as a C-Corp ETF by Alps. And we're pleased to have her. And with that, I'll hand it off to Stacey.
All right. Good morning, everyone. Thanks, Paul, and thank you, Nicolas, as well. It's a pleasure to be with you all this morning. I'm going to spend the next several moments just talking about performance for 2019 and then so far this year in 2020. I'll talk about fundamentals in terms of U.S. energy production and U.S. energy exports. I'll talk about some of the company-level improvements that we're seeing in this space, and then I'll also talk about the outlook for dividend and distribution growth this year. So if we start on the slide that has 2019 performance recap on the top, this shows performance for WTI crude, midstream, and broader energy on a relative basis for 2019. And specifically, the AMEI is the underlying index for ENFR. That index includes 25% MLPs, and then the other 75% is U.S. and Canadian midstream C-Corps. And then the AMZI is 100% midstream MLPs, and that's the underlying index for AMLP. And then the IXE is essentially the energy companies, as in the S&P 500. And I think there's a few points to make here if you're just kind of looking at 2019 performance. For one, oil prices were up almost 35% last year, but energy stocks in general were lagging those gains, and that's something that we've seen for some time. And I think there's a number of factors that play into that. In general, you have pretty significant underinvestment in energy equities, with energy representing just over 4% of the S&P 500 as of the end of December. You also have had people frustrated with energy companies around things like capital discipline and that kind of playing into the lag between energy equities and commodity prices. And then it's not on the chart, but we've also seen a lot of weakness in natural gas prices, and that can also weigh on energy equities as well. So if we look at 2019, oil prices, again, were up almost 35%, but broader energy is represented by the IXE, was only up about 12%. From a midstream perspective, the AMEI was up just over 22%. So we saw midstream actually perform very well in an environment with a lot of commodity price volatility. Midstream also benefited from strong Canadian midstream performance in 2019. About 33% of the AMEI is Canadian midstream C-Corps, and those tend to do better in periods of commodity price volatility. So, you know, if you're looking at 2019 in general, I think, you know, midstream was defensive. It provided defensive energy exposure, and it held up pretty well given the oil and gas price volatility that we saw. If you look at midstream MLPs and the purple line on the chart, midstream MLPs were hit pretty hard in October and November on a number of different factors. I think overall negative energy sentiment was pretty poor at that point. You had Chesapeake, which is an oil and gas producer, include going concern language in its 10Q, and that kind of raised concerns around the health of MLP and midstream counterparties and their customers. We also had concerns around production growth going forward, and then also at that point in the year, you run into tax loss selling as well. So all those factors kind of contributed to the weak performance that you saw in midstream MLPs in October and November. But it's notable to point out that we still saw, you know, pretty significant insider buying at that time. Management teams from Plains All American, PAA, Energy Transfer, ticker ET, for example, were actively buying units at that time, which is kind of nice to see when you're looking at that type of a sell-off. In December, oil prices rebounded, and you saw energy and midstream rebound, you know, pretty significantly as well. If we shift to kind of look at what's happened year to date, initially oil prices had a nice little jump after kind of increased tensions with Iran. That de-escalated pretty quickly, and then the focus really shifted to what's happened with coronavirus and what that means for oil demand. So on a year-to-date basis through last Friday, WTI crude prices are down about 18%. Natural gas prices are down about 15%. If we look at energy stocks, again, represented by the IXE, they're down about 10%. And midstream has actually held up much better. The AMZI is down about 6% on a total return basis. And then the AMEI, which is broader midstream, is only down about 3.5%. So even with the volatility that we've seen in oil and natural gas prices so far this year, midstream has continued to be a bright spot in the space and has continued to hold up relatively well compared to the rest of energy. It's also worth noting that we've seen solid earnings results for the fourth quarter so far from the midstream MLPs and C-Corps that have announced results. But if you're looking kind of just at performance on a year-to-date basis, a lot of that has been just dominated by the weakness in commodity prices. But overall, from a company level, I think things actually maybe look much better than what performance would suggest. If we go on to the next slide, I want to spend a little time just talking about what we're seeing from a fundamental perspective in terms of U.S. energy production and exports. With commodity price volatility that I mentioned, we're starting to see a slowdown in production growth, particularly for natural gas, but for oil as well, you know, relative to the steep growth that we saw over the last couple years. If you're looking at the slide, the blue line here is actual production, and then the orange line represents forecast for production growth from the Energy Information Administration, and then the green line on each chart represents exports. And it's important to keep in mind that the U.S. has become the world's largest producer of both oil and natural gas, and has become a major energy supplier to the rest of the world, just given the dominant production coming out of the U.S. And going forward, we would expect the U.S. to continue to play a very important role in terms of supplying other countries. Since the end of 2015, when the crude export ban was lifted, we've seen a nice increase in oil exports. And then in terms of natural gas exports, we've seen those increase for pipeline exports to Mexico and Canada, but also in terms of LNG or liquefied natural gas exports. If we go back to September of last year, the U.S. became a net exporter of petroleum for the first time since records began in the 1970s. The EIA expects the U.S. to become a net energy exporter this year, and by 2024, the U.S. is expected to become the world's largest LNG exporter. So the outlook for production growth and exports, you know, continues to be positive, and I think it's important to kind of keep in mind that there's a lot of infrastructure behind these export numbers. You need pipelines to get hydrocarbons from producing regions to hubs and then onto the coast. You need processing facilities to process natural gas into usable form. You need storage terminals to load hydrocarbons onto ships. And the midstream and MLP space is focused on all of those different areas. So as I said, there's a lot of infrastructure that goes into these types of export numbers. And I think while we're only showing, you know, projections for 2021, it's important to kind of keep in mind the long-term outlook for U.S. energy production. According to the International Energy Agency, the U.S. is expected to account for 85% of the total increase in global oil supply through 2030. On the natural gas side, the U.S. is expected to account for 30% of natural gas production growth through 2030. So while growth expectations for next year are moderating, the long-term outlook for the space is still very positive. And we'll talk a little bit more about how moderating production growth over the next couple of years is actually a good thing for MLPs and midstream in some subsequent slides. If we go on to the next slide, this shows AMLP performance, and the slide after it shows ENFR performance. These were necessary because we're now shifting to talk about the underlying indices for both funds. So those are there more for your reference as opposed to something that I'll spend time covering. But if we move on to the slide about now versus then, I think with performance in the space, it's easy to miss some of the improvements that we're actually seeing at a company level. So if you start with the chart on the left, leverage has been a focus for many MLPs and midstream, and we define leverage here as long-term debt divided by adjusted EBITDA. So if you look at 2016 versus 2018, that's trending in the right direction. Balance sheets have really been a priority, and they're clearly in a much better place than they used to be, and I would expect that 2019 metric to show improvement as well. If you shift to look at the table on the right, there's also been a lot of improvements in terms of MLPs. A number of MLPs have moved to eliminate their IDRs. If you're not familiar with IDRs or incentive distribution rights, they're essentially payments that MLPs would make to their parents as the distribution to unit holders grew. So over time, as distributions grew, the IDR amount would also grow and become more of a burden. And investors have really turned their nose to IDRs, and they've really fallen out of favor. And the space has responded by eliminating them from their structure. And we would expect that percentage to continue to increase. But today, by weight, 87% of the AMCI has eliminated their IDRs, which I think is a positive for the space. It's also important to note that distribution coverage for MLPs has also improved. When we talk about distribution coverage, we're just comparing basically cash coming in during the quarter to cash being paid out as distributions. And today, or as of the third quarter of 2019, coverage was 1.4 times, which essentially implies a 40% cushion between cash coming in and cash going out as distribution. So essentially, MLPs are better able to afford their distributions than in the past. And then it's notable that the index yield is actually higher today than it was in the end of 2016, despite some of the company-level improvements that we're seeing. So if we go on to the next slide, I think another important key theme for this year is that growth capital spending in the midstream space is moderating. And that coincides with what we're seeing with production growth slowing down, but also major multi-year projects reaching completion. For example, there are some large pipelines out of the Permian that started up in 2019 and will be starting up this year. And so as those projects reach completion, you have more cash flow coming in, but then you're also spending less in terms of future projects. So for the 19 companies shown, CapEx on average is declining by almost 30%. So again, you have more cash coming in from projects coming online and then less cash going out in terms of investment, which really creates more free cash flow. And there are a number of kind of company-level examples of free cash flow expected to start this year or into 2021. So to give a couple examples, Crestwood Equity Partners, ticker CEQP, is an MLP that expects to become free cash flow positive this year. They're hoping that will allow them to achieve leverage below 4x. And then they've also talked about the potential for shareholder returns as free cash flow increases. And notably, they increased their distribution just a couple weeks ago, and that was their first distribution increase since they cut back in 2016. So that's positive to see. Another example of an MLP is MPLX, which is targeting free cash flow after distributions in 2021. On the C-Corp side, Williams Companies, ticker WMB, is guiding to positive free cash flow in 2020 after its dividend. It's also expecting to grow its dividend by 5% this year. So it's nice to see free cash flow generation expected this year. Enbridge, ticker ENB, another large midstream C-Corp, is guiding to $3 to $4 billion of annual post-dividend free cash flow once its Line 3 project starts, which is expected later this year. So we're starting to see some names kind of turn the corner to generate free cash flow, starting this year and probably even more so into 2021. And if we go on to the next slide, this will hopefully kind of help frame the transition that we're seeing in this space. And simply put, if you used to follow this space several years ago, a lot has changed since then. If you go back to prior to 2014 when oil prices started to fall, MLPs were very prolific issuers of equity. They were also using a lot of debt, and they had heightened leverage because they were really building out the infrastructure to facilitate the growth in U.S. energy production that we saw on an earlier slide. In 2014, oil prices started to fall. Equity markets closed, leverage was still high, and generally needed to be reduced. And so things kind of had to change. And MLPs in midstream responded to that. Especially with equity markets closed, MLPs had to find new ways to fund their projects. Sometimes that was using preferred equity or private placements, but really the best solution was to just shift to using more retained cash flow. And the kind of example of this is Enterprise Products Partners, ticker EPD. In October 2017, they came out and announced that they would only grow their distribution by a quarter of a penny and essentially move towards self-funding the equity portion of their growth capital. Today, many names are self-funding their equity portion of their growth capital. They're still using debt, but they're not going out and issuing equity like they did in the past. And really, that's more unit holder friendly, it's more total return focused, and it also helps instill capital discipline in the space. And as I mentioned earlier, the space has also been focused on reducing debt and improving leverage. In some cases, we saw companies cut their distributions to better kind of right-size their payouts and be able to shift some of their capital allocation to things like paying down debt and self-funding projects. And so that transition has kind of been underway for a long time towards self-funding equity, and a lot of companies are doing that. And now we're getting to the point where companies can generate enough cash flow to not only cover their CapEx, but also to move towards covering their dividends. And I think as you see that happen, starting this year and into next year, that lays the groundwork for more buybacks and also potentially more dividend increases. So there are a few names on both the MLP and C-Corp side that have buyback programs in place. Examples on the C-Corp side are Cheniere, ticker LNG, Kinder Morgan, ticker KMI. On the MLP side, examples are Magellan Midstream, ticker MMP, Enterprise Products Partners, ticker EPD. So the key point here is that if it's been a while since you looked at the MLP or midstream space, it's not the same space that it was a few years ago. If you go back to 2014, it would have probably been unheard of for MLPs to consider buybacks. But now you have MLPs with buyback programs in place and more MLPs talking about things like buybacks. So the model for the space has really changed, and I think that's the kind of key takeaway from this slide. If we go on to the next slide, we always get questions around the outlook for dividend or distribution growth. This slide shows guidance for a couple MLPs and a couple C-Corps that have given guidance for dividends and distributions. On the MLP side, you can see the larger names in the space like Enterprise, Magellan, and Plainsville American are guiding to growth between 2 to 5%. There are a few smaller MLPs like CNX Midstream or Hess Midstream that are guiding to double-digit percentage growth for next year, or for 2020. But overall, we see MLP distributions kind of trending towards more modest distribution growth in that kind of 3 to 5% range. If you shift down and look at the C-Corps, there's notable growth from several names here. Kinder Morgan stands out for its 25% distribution growth. Enbridge and TC Energy are both Canadian names, guiding to 9 and close to 10% dividend growth next year. And then I mentioned earlier that Williams is guiding to 5% dividend growth. So you're seeing a pretty steady growth outlook for the names that have given guidance. I mentioned earlier that CEQP, a smaller MLP, announced a distribution increase for the first time in several years. And so I think there's a lot of positive trends here. It does bear noting that another MLP that's focused on gathering and processing, EnLink Midstream, did announce a distribution cut a couple weeks ago. So there are some companies that are still kind of in that process of right-sizing their distribution. But overall, I think your companies are in a much better position to afford their distributions than in the past. And if you shift over to look at the yield chart, I think it's important to note, just with yields where they are, that a significant portion of the companies in the AMZI and the AMEI by weighting are investment-grade companies. So about 70% of the AMZI is investment-grade by weighting, and about 73% of the AMEI is investment-grade by weighting. So to just kind of sum up the last several slides, I think performance for the space has been frustrating, but fundamentals remain constructive, and there's been a lot of company-level improvements that maybe belie some of that performance that we've seen. And I think overall, the financial positioning for this space is improving as you have companies moving more and more towards generating free cash flow, which really lays the groundwork for, I think, shareholder returns going forward. So with that, I'll shift it over to Paul to talk a little bit more about valuations and how to actually use your MLP products in portfolios.
Thank you, Stacey. And I think the important takeaway from those last few slides as we move on to the next slide is the idea that MLPs and energy infrastructure companies have been forced by the market to get their house in order, to improve their capital discipline. The flow chart that she showed, which speaks to self-funding and capital discipline leading to potential free cash flow generation above and beyond what's paid out in the form of distributions, is really a nice segue into the idea of valuation, because currently, if you look at how MLPs and energy infrastructure companies are valued relative to certain metrics, comparatively, when looking at other income-producing asset classes or the market writ large, what you can see is that the market hasn't been willing to pay a premium for some of these categories. And here on this midstream offers attractive free cash flow slides, free cash flow yield slide, you can see how discounted the category is relative to other parts of the market that are typically used in income strategies, REITs and utilities being two that jump off the page at you, and then the S&P 500, the sort of well-regarded market benchmark. And ultimately, free cash flow yield is just an inversion of the price to free cash flow ratio. And what it's saying is that these companies, which are improving their fundamental footing and are moving towards a future of increased free cash flow generation, haven't been rewarded to now by the market for doing so. And there's certainly no guarantee that they will in the future, but all these companies can do is what the market and the buy side has been asking of them, which is to rein in their capital expenditures, to improve their financial footing, and ultimately those things will translate to improved fundamentals, which in the parlance of the market should attract a new stream of investors. And we hear it often from a varied set of investors, advisors, individual investors, as well as institutional investors who either own the space and are thinking about adding, have owned the space in the past and are thinking about reentering, or are considering entering the space for the first time and are concerned about the general level of debt general level of leverage or the ability of these companies to sustain themselves into the future. And what you can see from a valuation case is a very compelling valuation relative to some of the proxies that you have in the market or other categories that people use alongside MLPs and energy infrastructure companies, at least historically. And as we move on to the next slide, you can see this from a different angle. You can look at enterprise value to EBITDA of different categories, including utilities in the S&P 500, and just how much those categories have been bid up relative to their earnings. And ultimately, what we see on the left is MLPs and energy infrastructure companies being discounted heavily relative to other categories in the market. And whether that's right or wrong is not for us to say, but what we're laying out here is a case for a category that has gotten its house in order, like I said, and is now being discounted to extreme valuations within the market. And the reality is that the energy sector, exclusive of or inclusive of energy infrastructure and MLP companies, has never been as small as it is now, or at least not in the past 30 years, in terms of its footprint in widely tracked market indexes. It's weighting in the S&P 500 is at near 30-year lows, and ultimately the sentiment around the energy space is depressed. But within energy, you have a category here, as Stacy pointed out earlier, that has a defensive orientation and has perhaps a lower volatility bent given the nature of cash flows and given the nature of their business profiles. And when you combine that with the fundamental backdrop and the valuations, all of a sudden you have an interesting story as we move into 2020, and how that will play out will be up to the marketplace. But ultimately, one of the questions we often get is, what are some of the potential catalysts for this space to see a reinvigoration of performance? And on the next slide, you can see what we think and what Alerian thinks are some of the potential catalysts are improved oil prices and energy sentiment. Obviously, for investors across the entire complex, from advisors to institutions to individual investors, there has been extremely negative sentiment to energy, and the beginning of 2020 has been challenged as a result of some of those macro and geopolitical factors that Stacy alluded to. But when you have additional buyback announcements, possibly in the offing, maybe continued activity from private equity firms, which could lead to major private equity transactions, and investors who have never looked at the space, perhaps starting to tiptoe into the space, and investors who had owned it in the past, reentering the space, all of those things are potential catalysts to drive this space meaningfully higher. And one of the things that's taking place behind all of these potential catalysts is a category that has extremely compelling yields, and we'll talk about that later. But when you think about the midstream energy infrastructure companies, and when you think about MLPs, you have yields that are as wide relative to other income-producing asset classes and fixed income indexes that are as wide as they've ever been. And ultimately, these relative valuation cases are part of the backbone of what we're talking about in 2020 with advisors and institutions around AMLP and ENFR. And the next slide just talks a little bit about the tax advantages of AMLP, which, of course, is a C-Corp MLP-only ETF. And historically, you can see that the vast majority of its dividends or its distributions have been considered tax-deferred return of capital. And as an investor in AMLP, that means that when that distribution is paid, you don't pay taxes on those distributions immediately. It lowers the cost basis of your investment in AMLP until which time you decide to sell AMLP. And at that point, those distributions will be taxed. And in years where you have perhaps a smaller percentage of that distribution that's paid out as a return of capital, those distributions are taxed as qualified distributions as any dividend income stream is. And ultimately, that's one of the cases for AMLP. Stacy did a great job earlier of talking about the long horizon, long-term nature of some of this valuation and fundamental case that's being built here. But ultimately, the case for AMLP isn't necessarily as a tactical play, but perhaps as a longer-term structural play for investors who need income, who need yield within their portfolio, and are not in a tax or not in a qualified account, but perhaps looking to take advantage of the tax-deferred nature of the income stream that AMLP throws off. And when you compare, as we do on the next slide, investments and distributions from AMLP to those of, say, a blue-chip corporate or a bond coupon payment, you can see just how tax-advantaged the nature of that income stream is, both when you're thinking about the deferred return of capital distributions and the overall nature of that income profile. And that ultimately is one of the important considerations when thinking about an AMLP relative to other investments, but even perhaps relative to other energy investments. The space, because prices are so depressed across the energy space, does have very attractive yields, but the nature of yields being thrown off by AMLP is distinct from the nature of yields being thrown off by any other segment of the energy complex writ large. And when we think about investment in the category, Stacey showed you the relative performance of the Alerian Energy Infrastructure Index as well as the Alerian MLP Infrastructure Index. And because there are two distinct products, one being AMLP and one being ENFR, investors and advisors are faced with a choice between the two. And that choice comes down to a couple different decision points, one of which is your ultimate goal to get as much yield as possible? Is your ultimate goal to realize the benefits of the tax-deferred nature of that yield? And perhaps, is it part of an estate planning process whereby you plan to pass along this investment through an inheritance? And if so, it's important to remember that even though your basis goes down with every return of capital distribution, when that investment is inherited or passed down, there is a step up in basis. And so that difference can be very compelling for estate planning purposes. But again, this is all part of the process of advising clients, investing on their behalf, building asset allocations that meet their needs, and then adjusting them at the margins or within specific categories to meet various objectives. And in the case of income, AMLP, given that it throws off such a significant yield and such a strong portion of which historically has been tax deferred, makes a very compelling choice for investors focused on yield in a taxable account. Whereas ENFR, which is a much more diversified portfolio with a cap of MLPs of 25% of the portfolio and a geographical expansion into Canada at about 30% of the portfolio, offers a distinct investment profile. Yes, it does throw off a compelling yield, but it also provides perhaps a better total return opportunity. And if an investor is in a qualified account, such as an RIA or a rolled over 401k, ENFR may be a more appropriate investment. And ultimately, what ENFR offers is real asset exposure that caps MLP exposure at 25%, but you get that broad diversified exposure to energy infrastructure from processing to transport to storage, and it still has many of the same characteristics of an MLP-only investment strategy, meaning it's a defensively oriented energy play, and it has, as we'll show later, low correlation to other bond proxies, traditional income strategies, and fixed income, but it also provides a distinct investment opportunity from AMLP or an MLP-only investment. And what I'd like to do is just take a step back here and hand it back over to Stacey to walk through how midstream compares to other investment asset classes that are widely followed and widely compared to ENFR and AMLP, and then also talk about how the products and the indexes have performed in rising interest rate environments historically.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. So as Paul mentioned, you typically MLPs or midstream are providing real asset exposure, and we see a lot of people use them for real asset exposure just given the inflation-protected nature of their cash flows. You can also use MLPs in midstream for defensive energy exposure. As Paul talked about, there's less commodity exposure, and then you're also getting the benefit of higher income or higher yields compared to other energy sectors. But most of the people that we talk to are really using energy infrastructure for income or within income portfolios. So in that context, I think it's important to understand that midstream has low correlations with other income-oriented investments. And you can see on the slide correlations over different time periods for the AMZI, again, which is the underlying for AMLP, and then AMEI, which is the underlying for ENFR. And you can see that correlations, particularly with utilities and bonds, are pretty low over all of those periods. There's a little more correlation with REITs, but overall, for the long-term periods, it's still below 0.5. So if you're thinking about accessing the MLP space through a product like AMLP or ENFR, it can be a nice diversifier to an income portfolio. Or if you're just thinking about allocating within the context of a broader portfolio, the diversified portfolio, it's just worth keeping in mind that MLPs are not in your broader market indices. So that's kind of another layer of diversification as well. If we go on to the other slide, Paul talked about using this as a long-term allocation, and rising interest rates may not be an immediate concern. But again, if you're planning to make a long-term allocation, that may be something that you're wondering about. And sometimes you run into the perception that MLPs are sensitive to rising rates, just given the yield-oriented nature of the investment. And rising rates can be a headwind in two potential ways. First, fixed income investments become more competitive, so essentially you have more competition for investor dollars as interest rates increase. And then the other potential headwind is that borrowing costs rise. If we look at the three different periods shown here where interest rates rose by over 100 basis points, MLPs outperformed other yield-oriented sectors like REITs and utilities in those environments. Going back to 2013 to looking more recently in 2017 and 2018. And I think a couple things have helped MLPs perform better. One, when we looked at MLP debt for AMZI constituents and did the data based on the third quarter of 2018, about 85% of AMZI constituent debt was fixed. So debt's largely fixed, so there's not as much exposure to kind of floating interest rates. Another kind of factor working in MLP's favor is that yields are already elevated for the MLP space. So a higher bond yield isn't really significantly increasing competition because MLP yields are already so elevated to begin with. And if we look at the 10-year correlation between the AMZI and the 10-year Treasury yield, it's only about 0.23, so not a significant correlation there either. So again, maybe not something that's an immediate concern, but if you are thinking about making a long-term allocation and wondering about interest rates, we've generally seen MLPs hold up pretty well in rising rate environments compared to other income-oriented investments. So I think with that, we'll probably shift to Q&A, and I'll turn it back over to Paul to kind of kick off the Q&A session.
Thank you, Stacey. So one of the questions we received, which I think is a pretty nice way to sum up a lot of what we just discussed, is what will it take to improve investor sentiment toward energy and midstream? And before I hand it off to you for your thoughts, Stacey, I would like to say that if you look at the past year, investor sentiment may not have led to strong performance, at least not in 2020. It certainly did support the energy infrastructure space in 2019 relative to energy and relative to MLP-specific investments. But we saw last year, or since the beginning of last year, roughly $1 billion, just short of $1 billion, flow into midstream ETFs, and just about $100 million flow into MLP-only ETFs. And so what you can see is investors are sort of voting with their dollars in terms of moving or positioning into the midstream space and sort of waiting for MLPs to realize a lot of what we've been talking about in terms of the fundamental improvements and the valuation case playing out. But the market, in terms of flows, is saying that sentiment is somewhat positive for the category, at least over the course of the past calendar year plus. Stacey, I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, sure, Paul. I mean, I think from a sentiment perspective, you need to see continued execution at the company level. Across energy, there's a focus on things like capital discipline, a focus on returns and generating healthy returns, a focus on kind of moving more towards generating free cash flow. And I think you know, to the extent that midstream and MLPs can execute on that, that'll be positive for the space. But execution on that more broadly across energy, I think it's one way to kind of help improve sentiment in the space and maybe bring more interest back into the space. Obviously, it's less or more difficult to control, but I think to the extent that you see less commodity price volatility, that can also be helpful for improving sentiment in this space. You know, one of the things we say all the time is that the cure for low prices is low prices. And so as we see producers respond to lower natural gas prices and lower oil prices by curbing some of their activity, I think that sets up for a healthier kind of supply-demand balance, which then can lead to kind of a more constructive price environment going forward as well. So I would kind of sum it up with those 2 points. I mean, less commodity volatility would certainly be helpful in bringing sentiment back up. But at the company level, in terms of things that companies can control, it's really focused on execution, operating with capital discipline, and for the midstream space, you know, more and more focused on free cash flow and using that to return cash to shareholders through buybacks or dividend increases. And I think that will bring you more attention back to the space as well.
Great. So another question we had, and you spoke a little bit about the overall investment grade footprint within the indexes, but one of the questions that came in was about whether or not there are concerns about debt obligations for MLPs and or energy infrastructures across the board.
Yeah, as you mentioned, I mean, a significant portion of the companies in both indices by weight are investment grade companies, and that really comes from the fact that these companies were doing a lot of projects and using a lot of debt in the past, and so that investment grade credit rating has been very important to a number of companies. In terms of concerns for debt, I mean, I think in general balance sheets have improved over the last couple of years, as I talked about. And for those names that maybe haven't seen as much improvement, I think that remains a focus. Clearly, from a capital allocation standpoint, it doesn't really make sense to move on to things like buybacks if your balance sheet isn't in a good position. So for the names that are still, you know, maybe working on some of those balance sheet concerns, I think that's still going to be a priority and that's still going to be a focus. I also mentioned earlier that a significant portion of MLP debt is fixed versus floating. So I think that's, you know, generally kind of a good thing as well in the event that we do see, you know, an interest rate rise at some point. But overall, I think, you know, balance sheets are a much better place than they were. And so debt concerns, I think, you know, have started to be alleviated. In some cases, there are companies where more work can be done. But overall, I think we continue to see an improvement, and I think that trend will continue.
Great. So the next question I wanted to get to is, how does midstream hold up during low commodity price environments relative to, say, EMPs or oil field service companies or the energy sector?
Sure. So we talked a little bit about MLPs and midstream providing more defensive energy exposure, and that really goes back to the fee-based nature of their cash flows. And that's something we haven't really talked about, but when you look at midstream assets like pipelines, like storage facilities, processing plants, you're generally charging a fee based on throughput. So it may be a couple dollars per each barrel of crude that you move, you know, a certain amount for each MMCF of natural gas that you process, those sorts of fee-based businesses. And that's really what helps MLPs and midstream perform more defensively relative to your other sectors of energy. So I mentioned year-to-date performance at the beginning of the call. If you look, again, you know, year-to-date through Friday, the AMZI is down about 6% on a total return basis. The AMEI is down about 3.5%. But that's, you know, still holding up much better than the other sectors of energy. The IXE, which is the energy companies in the S&P 500, is down about 10%. And if you look more specifically at E&Ps, as represented by the SPSIOP index, they're down about 19%. That's an E&P-focused index. The oil field service index, the OSX, is down about 17.6%. So you're seeing E&Ps and oil field services perform more in line with the commodity price weakness that we've seen, while MLPs and midstream have held up better. And I would expect that trend to continue to the extent that we continue to see commodity volatility. Midstream and MLPs have really been kind of the safe place to hide within energy, just given the fee-based nature of their cash flows. And we've seen that year to date. We've seen that in other periods where oil prices have been particularly weak, including the fourth quarter of 2018 when oil prices fell about 40%. Midstream was maybe down about half that, whereas E&Ps and oil field services were down more than that. So the space has been defensive in periods of volatility for commodity prices, and I would expect that to continue.
Great. That's very helpful perspective. So one of the questions, and I think it's really topical because you and I were just down in Florida for Inside ETFs, and you couldn't reach out your arm without running into someone who was talking about ESG, and you guys have recently written a white paper on the topic. And so the question comes in is, what impact do you see on energy infrastructure investment with the increased focus on ESG investing by both individuals and institutions?
Sure. So I think ESG has been, you know, in focus for investors broadly, and it's certainly been a focus within the energy space as well. And I think it's important to kind of keep in mind that MLPs and midstream and ESG don't have to be mutually exclusive just because midstream is transporting, you know, fossil fuels. For example, ONEOK, ticker OKE, is an example of a C Corp that's in the Dow Jones Sustainability Index. So it's not, you know, that these things can't, you know, coexist and can't cooperate together. We've seen a number of MLPs and midstream companies move to increase their disclosure around ESG factors, include more information about governance, more information around emissions or spills and things like that that occasionally happen in the space. So overall, the midstream space has been responsive to investor questions around ESG. In improving disclosures, there's more work that can be done, and obviously it's difficult because there isn't, you know, necessarily standardized midstream measures around what should be disclosed in those different categories. But the space has done a good job, I think, of taking the initiative to improve disclosures and be more upfront about that. And if ESG and midstream is something that you're interested in from an investor standpoint, we did a white paper this fall that goes into more detail. It looks at company-level performance on different metrics across ESG, and I think that would be a really helpful kind of starting point if you're looking at, you know, how midstream has done in terms of ESG-type factors. But overall, you know, it's certainly a trend in the market and something that midstream management teams are certainly in tune with.
Yeah, and I would just add to that that I think when people see the acronym ESG, they often focus on the E, and that's largely because there's been so much focus on climate change and the nature of the political cycle and the focus by a lot of candidates on things like the Green New Deal, and that ultimately drives people to the E in that acronym. But the reality is the G is really important as well, and as Stacey and Alarion have laid out in many forums and in the white paper that she described, the governance piece is something that a lot of MLP companies have moved to shore up, and whether that means removing IDRs, whether that means trying to figure out a way to create voting rights for investors in MLPs, these are all part of their governance shift, and I think speaks to an improvement on the ESG outlook for the space. And it's also important to note that the nature of midstream energy infrastructure is flexible, and in a future where we're moving around other energy sources other than petrochemicals, other than petroleum, other than natural gas, a lot of these pipelines can shift to other energy sources and moving around other energy sources. And although it hasn't made its way out of Congress, there has been legislation in the past to expand the definition of MLPs to include alternative energy companies. Not that we expect that to be passed anytime soon, but it was a bipartisan initiative. It was a bipartisan bill, and that does speak to the importance of energy infrastructure in not only servicing the current iteration of the energy infrastructure in the United States, but also the future state and how energy infrastructure's definition is perhaps too narrow currently as people think about it, and tying that back into ESG, the future state of the space and how it might relate to an ESG investment thesis. So one of the the points that we get a lot, or one of the questions we get a lot, is around C-Corp conversions, and I think we'd be remiss if we didn't tackle that one head on. So one of the questions that came through is, what are the primary factors that have driven MLP to C-Corp conversions? Do you expect that trend to continue? And finally, is the overall quality of the MLP sector lower due to the companies that have exited through conversion?
Yeah, sure. So to your point, that does come up a lot in our conversations with investors. And I think there's a misconception that MLPs are just, you know, choosing to convert to C-Corps. And typically what we've seen in the past is really C-Corp parents buying in their MLPs or potentially a merger transaction with the C-Corp as a surviving entity. It's worth noting that we also saw a lot of merger transactions in 2018 and 2019 where the MLP was a surviving entity. So another misconception that I hear is that MLPs are converting to C-Corps because of lower tax rate. And really, you know, what we saw in the transactions that happened, again, most often it was a C-Corp parent consolidating their MLP. The focus of the transaction was really simplifying structure, so consolidating into one listed entity or even eliminating incentive distribution rights. There's far fewer examples of MLPs just electing to be taxed as a corporation, and you know, almost no examples in the midstream space, maybe one or two. So we think broadly the trend of parents consolidating their MLPs is largely behind us because the areas where that made sense for individual companies or their parents, that's largely been done. More recently, we've heard you know, more focus around you know, the potential for some large MLPs potentially just choosing to convert to a C-Corp, and I think a lot goes into evaluating that, right? I think companies are considering what future corporate tax rates might look like, what may happen with the election this year, what would be the tax implications of a transaction if there were to be one, and how that would impact unit holders, and then you know, whether the perceived benefits of a C-Corp structure really offset that. And typically when we talk about the benefits of a C-Corp structure, you know, most people are focused on kind of the eligibility for broader indices. But to a point Paul made earlier, and in terms of the ESG question, you know, one of the knocks on MLPs relative to C-Corps has been weaker corporate governance. And that's an example of something that an MLP can address within the MLP structure without having to change its structure. So in sum, I think you know, MLPs are evaluating all these things. And overall, the question around structure is something that we'll continue to follow closely and monitor. To the question around whether the overall quality of the MLP sector is lower, I think you know, in general, if you look at the MLP space, it's still a fairly concentrated space. And even if you look at the AMZI, the five largest names are all capped right around 10%, which is the index cap. So Enterprise Products Partners, Plains All American, Magellan Midstream Partners, MPLX, Energy Transfer, those are all your household kind of MLP names. And those you know, really make up the bulk of the index with all having about 10% weights. They represent about 50% of the index. So it's really you know, the larger names in the space that have been you know, garnering a larger weight in the index as changes have happened. But the space, I think, in general, is still, you know, representative of a diverse MLP space. You still have diversification in terms of the types of companies, in terms of focus on pipeline transportation or gathering and processing. And the underlying assets for the midstream companies included in AMZI is still, you know, the same types of assets. So it's still pipelines, it's still gathering and processing, still storage focus. So while the names have changed, the underlying assets really haven't, and it's still those kind of fee-based shipping and handling items that are still in the index today. So that's how I would kind of address the last part of that question.
Great. And we've got about 5 minutes left, but I'm just going to throw out one final question, which I think is probably most relevant to ENFR. In 2019, we saw a strong relative performance from the Canadian infrastructure companies. And I'd like to get your perspective on what you think was driving that. Was it better a better legislative environment or regulatory environment? Was it better operational performance? Or was it just a nature of the Canadian marketplace relative to the U.S. marketplace?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of things that played into it. The Canadian names in 2018 also probably struggled a little more than the U.S. names. So in some of it, In some cases, it was kind of a reversion from maybe a weaker 2018. But overall, Canadian midstream names tend to be more defensive. The Canadian midstream names really didn't cut their distributions or dividends at all when oil prices fell. They're more kind of steady state, and I think overall the Canadian investor base is better in terms of kind of stomaching some of the volatility in commodity prices, just given Canada's overall focus on energy. So it's kind of a combination of factors, but certainly in a an environment with commodity price and volatility, we would generally expect Canadian names to hold up well and to be defensive, and that's really what we saw play out in 2019.
Great. Thank you, Stacey. And now that we're up against time, I'm going to take a moment here to thank everyone for joining us. We so appreciate you spending this hour with us. We hope that it was informative and helps lay a foundation for an understanding of the category and the investment opportunity ahead of us in 2020 and beyond. And of course, if you have any questions, please do not hesitate to reach out to us. And all the best with your clients and your investment strategies as we progress in 2020.
Thank you from Capital Link as well. It was a very informative webinar. Thank you for being with us. And we look forward to the next one. And please, this webinar will be available as an archive if anybody would like to come back and visit it again. And we hope to see you all at the Capital Link's 19th Annual Closed-End Funds and Global ETFs Forum in New York on Tuesday, April 7th. Thank you again. And all disconnect.
Thank you. That does conclude the webinar for today. Thank you for participating. You may all disconnect.